Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. Today, we're ditching the microphone for the camera and putting BBC documentary maker Michael Cockerill under the spotlight. Cockerill has spent his entire career getting politicians to open up on the small screen, and now his memoirs, Unmasking Our Leaders, reveals exactly how he did it, alongside plenty of anecdotes. Welcome, Michael.
Michael Cockerill, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you for coming on. We're here to chat about your book, Unmasking Our Leaders, which will be out now. This is basically just a look at your life and how, as I understand it, it intertwines with that of the prime ministers and the politicians that you spend much of your career interviewing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just writing the book, I hadn't sort of quite seen it like that, but it's quite interesting. Many of the kind of pivotal moments in British politics, one way or another, I've been there or filming behind the scenes, or know someone or lucky enough to know the Prime Minister of the day and was filming there. So it's interesting that sometimes I was like Forrest Gump, I was in the room at the time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a star-studded cast, I think, in your book. And I think one of the best things about it, reading it, is, you know, for myself, I wasn't really alive for much of the book, but looking at these figures.
Good. It's meant to be sort of there are a lot of, I hope, good anecdotes and so on, but it's also a sort of political history of the 50 years that I've been making television, films and documentaries.
Yeah, you do feel like you're in the room with them. It is really nice because bringing the anecdotes in goes a long way towards humanising these people. Obviously, like, I didn't know Churchill, but reading about the screen test that he did, you know, how much he hated television and the little poem that he read, like, it certainly does, like, go a long way to humanising the man, which is really nice.
Yes. That story, I was one day at a party and suddenly Peter Mandelson glid into the room, whatever the past tense of glide is, but he would appear in a room without having walked through the door. He's suddenly, he's at your shoulder, and you only notice because there's a sudden chill in the room. And he said to me, "You do the most important thing you can do for a politician." I said, "Really? What's that, Peter?" He said, "You make them appear human." And then glid away, just as I was going to say, it might be difficult with you, Peter, but he'd gone, leaving only the faintest whiff of sulfur. And I thought, that is a spin doctor's take on what I do. You make them appear human. I try to bring out the human side, that the normal kind of discourse between a sort of two men in suits shouting at each other rather hides. So I'm trying to bring out the human side, where he thinks that spin doctor, you make them appear human.
You know, you've had how many years in journalism? 50 years, 60 years? What are your tricks for doing just that in that case? Like, what have you picked up over your career for getting the best out of your interviewees?
Yeah, well, I'm lucky in terms of what I do, making political documentaries, so they're filmed and you have all the advantages of the cutting rooms, and so you can talk to people for a very long time and only use the bits where you think they're really telling it as it is. So lots of it just goes down on the cutting room floor, but some of the stuff which didn't make it into the film, very definitely in the book, and what it was like making these films and so on. Also, I always try, and when I'm doing a sort of biography of a politician, try and take them to places which might kind of spark something in them. So someone like Ted Heath, who was notoriously curmudgeonly difficult to interview, I took him back to Broadstairs, where he was born. And grew up, went to school in Broadstairs, you know, till he was 18. And when he arrived for the interview, his driver took him down separately from us. He stopped, got out of the car, and he just said, "Smell that air, smell that air, best air in Britain." And, you know, he was relaxed, he was back. Back in the womb in some ways. And we laid on a lunch for him, and he just wanted asparagus and soup, and that's it. He never eat much before a big interview. That's what he said to me. So he had trained himself more or less for the interview. When I talked to him, he sort of opened up in a way that I'd never seen him open up before, and talked about his first girlfriend whom he never married and all that. And it was fascinating. And I thought then that I'd got through. And the next time that when I talked to him, he would be much more open, but turned out the opposite. He'd given me a glimpse of his life, and that was it. He closed the door after that. And one of his oldest friends, who was Sir Robert Armstrong, Lord Armstrong, who later became the cabinet secretary, he said he liked the film. I said I had great difficulty in getting anything personal from him. He said, in your 50-minute film, you got more out of him than I got out of him in 50 years of friendship. So I thought that was nice, because Heath himself was quite funny. He had a sort of black sense of humour. I remember one day he arrived for an interview, and he said, have you got the usual list of boring questions? I said, yes, I'm afraid I have. So we did the interview, and it went rather better than usual. And I said, did you think the questions were as boring as usual? Oh, yes, but infinitely more irrelevant today. And I said to his private secretary this story, and he said, oh, well, if he's rude to you, it means he likes you.
That's reassuring.
He was always rude to me.
I mean, like, anecdotes like that, I think, are a reason themselves for going into journalism. But when you started out, I imagine you didn't know that this was what you were going to be doing, or like this was the caliber of person that you were going to end up interviewing. So just to take you back to, I suppose, the start of your career, what made you want to go into journalism and then from there into political reporting?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always been fascinated by politics from the earliest age I can remember. My parents were quite political. They were members of the local Labour Party in Northwest London, where I was brought up and went to school. And so there would sometimes be meetings of the local constituency Labour Party in our house. And they were also members of the Fabian Society, which was the sort of centre-left think tank of the Labour Party, still exists. And I would go to summer schools there and see many big politicians or people who became big politicians at the Fabian Summer School. And there's even a picture of me in the book with a number of famous politicians, Roy Jenkins and Bill Rogers and Gerald Kaufman in a cricket team, and little old me, age 14, wearing cricket whites and sitting up, and I was the only one wearing whites. So I sort of mixed with politicians at a very early age, and then I went to Oxford, and I was fascinated by the politics at Oxford. I remember I went up in 1959. When Harold Macmillan won his big landslide victory. I remember the very first day at the Freshers' Fair, there was the Oxford University Conservative Association chalking up all the results on the board. And then I went to the Labour Party stall, and they were all downcast. And their very first meeting that weekend was going to be Labour, psychologically happier in opposition, discuss. And so there I was in the middle, and I joined all the political societies and would go and see various politicians, top politicians, who would all come down. It's quite quick. You'd get on the train on Paddington, unless you're driven there, and you get there in an hour. And so they're prepared to do that, apart from the prestige of whichever of the societies they would come and talk to.
Yeah, I mean, it must be very exciting. Politics, I imagine, even for reporters as well as politicians, is a bit of a drug, isn't it? The excitement of election day, the kind of the very intricate social relationships between MPs, you know, who's in the cabinet, who's not, who's rising through the ranks. And then when you were a reporter, of course, most of your career was with the BBC, and they are very famously neutral. Do you think it's important for political reporters and documentary makers to not let their biases influence their work?
Yeah, well, it's a question that I'm often been asked. I would say that what the BBC is best at is being impartial, being fair. And the easiest thing in the world would be to sort of use television for your own prejudice and bias. But much the most interesting thing is to try and get at the truth. Just try and find out what's really going on. And almost always throughout my life, when I've been making films about politicians and politics, the truth has turned out to be much more interesting than the caricatures in the newspapers of what was going on. Often you would find that the man who was a heroic figure or woman would have flaws and sometimes feet of clay. And often you would find that the person who was the hate figure, the bogeyman, had redeeming characteristics. It was never, ever black and white. And it's just, you know, people have sometimes said to me, who's your next victim? And I say, it's not a victim. I'm trying to create a portrait, to draw a portrait. It's a profile of someone. They're not victims, they're subjects of a painter who is trying to get a true likeness. And most of the time in politics, politicians spend their whole time sort of polishing up their image, putting the gloss on. And I've spent my whole time as a reporter scratching it off.
I do like the way you put it in your book. At the start, you go through the different prime ministers, you know, introducing the age of television. Like I said before, Churchill famously hated television. Harold Wilson kind of had a kind of flirtation with it, I suppose.
It was a sort of love-hate relationship, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I like the way you describe it as, it comes across as a very much a democratizing force, you know, like you were saying, one party can portray the leader of the opposition as some kind of demonic figure, but if you see them on television immediately, obviously they're just a person like anyone else. And when you were starting out, of course, television, I suppose, was kind of in its infancy as an art form, I suppose, or like a way of reporting. What was it like to be part of that movement? Because obviously now television is, you know, ubiquitous. It's the main way we receive the news. But what was it like starting out in that industry?
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting when I first went into television, and just before that, the leading politicians of the day, you know, as I was growing up, like Churchill himself, Churchill thought it was just a tuppenny halfpenny Punch and Judy show, and it will never have any role to play in politics. And Clement Attlee, the Labour leader who'd been Prime Minister, felt the same about it. But gradually, politicians began to see that television could be a hugely influential medium. And I think it first sort of started in as early as, well before I was working in television, but I remember the Queen's coronation in 1953. And suddenly the amount of television sets sort of doubled overnight because everyone wanted to see the coronation on television. Churchill didn't want it to be on television, but his private secretary told me that Churchill said, well, I don't want it to be on television, but she is, after all, the Queen, so I better, she is the monarch, so she better have her way. Suddenly, at least half the population was watching it, not on their own sets. They would go to next door who had a television, because most people didn't have television. So there were big, including in my own house, so there were big sort of coronation viewing parties with the rest of the people in the street all crowded into, and politicians thought, maybe this is a medium I need to use.
Over your career, you've interviewed so many massive names, you know, Margaret Thatcher, Barbara Castle. Do you think that the age of the superstar politician, you know, these massive names who would dominate headlines, has that passed now? Or do you think we're entering a new one? I guess Boris Johnson does make headlines, but he doesn't strike me as a titanic figure in politics the same way like Thatcher was.
Most times in my life, people have looked back at the politicians of previous ages and thought, what big figures. We don't have such big figures now. I think a lot of people become bigger figures after they stopped being prime minister. Let me think. I'd be very surprised if some of the people in Boris Johnson's current cabinet will be seen as political titans in years to come.
Is there anyone that you'd really like to get behind a camera that you haven't, from the current cabinet or from today's politics, I suppose, that you wish you that you would like to be able to interview?
Luckily, I've done interviews with Boris Johnson, and I did a film about Boris Johnson, the only biography he said that he made, that he allowed the cameras properly in for. But I think to be filming inside Number 10 at this time would be endlessly fascinating, and to see exactly where the power lies, especially where the power lies since Dominic Cummings left. I mean, Dominic Cummings was one that got away from me and everyone else, although he's sort of making it up for it now on his blog. Mm. But he was absolutely camera shy.
Yes, I can imagine he'd be quite a slippery individual to pin down. And then kind of looking back again to your earlier days in making documentaries, working for the BBC, one thing I didn't realise right at the start of your career was that you were essentially a war correspondent. That must have been quite a contrast to your later work in politics. Do you feel that helped you in any way, the war correspondent working in these very dangerous places? Do you feel like that prepared you for the world of political reporting in any way?
Yeah, I mean, when I first worked in television, I worked for a now long gone programme I first worked for a programme called 24 Hours, which was a big programme every night after the news. And there wasn't a news at 10. And so that was the previous news was at 9 o'clock or even earlier. We did everything, both domestic stories and foreign stories. And I began to be sent to making films in dodgy parts of the world, like the Middle East and after the Civil War in Nigeria. And in Nigeria, it was quite difficult to film there. There'd been a brutal civil war. Mm. We were talking earlier about impartiality. But when there's a civil war in a country, one of the things is that the government obviously takes over total control of the media, and the rebels set up their own rebel stations. And so if the BBC comes in and is broadcasting neutrally, as they would see it, as we would see it, the government regards you as, and it will no doubt be happening in Afghanistan soon, regards you as enemies. You know, I remember we went, when we were filming in Nigeria at the end of the Civil War, I went up to this guy, and if you were looking to, he was the chief information officer of the Ministry of Information. Fat guy with dark glasses, I said to him, "Mr. Apelli, we're having problem getting interviews with anyone doing any proper filming here. Can you help me?" He looked at me with sort of hatred in his eyes and said, "It will do the BBC good to eat some of its own poison for a change." Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm going to be getting very far here. We flew to a nearby West African state where the leader of the rebels we thought was there and were looking for him. And they arrested us as British spies and put us in jail. And that was pretty hairy. And another time I was in Jordan, at the time of what was called Black September in 1970, where terrorists have hijacked three aeroplanes and taken them to the desert, decanted the passengers and blew the planes up. It was terrorism is armed propaganda, and this is an extraordinary piece of. They did it for the TV cameras. While we were in Jordan, the civil war started with the King of Jordan sort of taking on the Palestinian freedom fighters that were camped all around Jordan, and we were stuck in the middle of it. And for days, we were in this hotel where the shells were all coming in. We were sort of in a bathroom, about eight of us in this small communal bathroom, where there were two walls between us and the outside world. But when a shell came and killed someone in the next house to the hotel, we felt, well, I remember feeling that no one really knows we're here, and it's a bit undignified to die without anyone knowing where you are. And I was married that year, and my wife was pregnant, and my mother-in-law said to her, I can't bear it, widowed before you've had the child, just like the First World War. So I didn't necessarily make things feel much better for her, but luckily we managed to get out on a Red Cross plane. I mean, my early experience was both filming in difficult and dangerous places around the world, but also doing political films in England. And I suppose every story one makes as a TV film maker, or a reporter or producer, you learn something, and you learn a whole lot about the country and how to get things done in the country. But you also learn a great deal about how to put people at their ease when you're filming with them. And all politicians develop a veneer, and they have their own kind of biography of their life, which they normally trot out to journalists, which they've been doing for many years, and they're normally quite funny and quite self-deprecating, but it's often nothing like the truth. And if you do as I've done, before I do the profile of the politician, I go around and talk to various people, say civil servants or relations or friends or enemies of the person I'm talking to. So you get to the happy position sometimes. I remember former Prime Minister Jim Callaghan said, hang on, you seem to know more about my life than I do. And I thought that was a great compliment. And I said, I'm sure I don't know more about your life than you do, but I may know a bit more about what we're talking about because I've spent the last week studying. You probably haven't thought about it for 40 years. But it's then when they say the line that they've been trotting out for years, and you say, oh, interesting you say that, because I talked to so-and-so who was your deputy or your chief civil servant or your wife. They said, and then this sudden looking comes into their eyes and they think, maybe it was like that. And then they suddenly start, and it comes out fresh. And that's a great moment when you get that.
Yeah, I can imagine that's very satisfying to get that moment on camera. With that in mind, who is there a political interview that stands out to you as the best one you've done, or your favourite one that you've done?
Wow. One of the ones which I always remember was in Downing Street in 1989. So Mrs. Thatcher was celebrating her 10th wedding anniversary, and she only gave one interview, and happily she gave it to me. And I said to Mrs. Thatcher, I was talking to your deputy. Retired. He was called Willie Whitelaw, Lord Whitelaw, and he'd been Deputy Prime Minister for all her time. And I was making a film about him, and I said, how did you see your job as deputy to Mrs. Thatcher? He said, well, it was my job really to go there and hose her down a bit from time to time. I thought it was a lovely line. But I said to Mrs. Thatcher, I was talking to Lord Whitelaw about you, and you're celebrating your 10th anniversary, and I And I said to Mrs. Thatcher, I asked Willie Whitelaw how long he thought that you would remain Prime Minister. And he said, well, very good, very competent, very strong, very fit. And I hope she'll be there for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And I said to Whitelaw, but she's not immortal. He said, no, not immortal, but perhaps she is. And I recounted this to Mrs. Thatcher. And she said, what a sweet thing of Willie to say. No, I am not immortal. And I don't know how long I'll go on. And no one can know that, Michael. But the interesting thing, when I looked at the film again, when I said to her, he said, not immortal, but perhaps she is. And the look that comes into her eyes, it's only for a few frames, suddenly someone has suggested to her that she's not immortal. And you know, may just be, you know, what's Cockerell going to ask next? Or maybe an intimation of mortality, which she hadn't had before.
It must be fascinating to interview someone like Margaret Thatcher, especially because from the early days of her career, when I suppose she was not polished at all to this kind of national institution that she was by the end of her political career.
Yeah.
It must be quite striking to see the difference, you know, when you look back at the footage and think, oh, I was the person who managed to get that smidgen of, you know, humanity or genuine emotion from her.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I did say to her later on, you know, when I first filmed you, you know, you seemed to be almost afraid of the camera, as if you felt you had a superstition that it would take your soul away. And she said, yes, I know what you mean. But now I know that what you people want is a positive answer. And so I will always give you a positive answer. And in a way, that was right. Even when she was saying, no, 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 she gave you something that you could use.
Yeah, that's the mark of a seasoned professional, I suppose. And then, you know, you've had a ringside seat essentially on politics for so long and have been a political reporter for so long. How do you feel like the relationship between the media and politicians has changed from when you started to what it's like now?
Would you like to read my two previous books, which were alive? The thing is, the relationship with politicians, between politicians and the media and television in a way particularly, is this love-hate relationship. We need them, they need us. We can't do our job without them at reporting politics, and they know that they will try every means they can to use the television as, you know, to put forward their spin on the story. So it's always a touchy relationship. The nerve ends are often quite raw as far as the relationship is concerned. Some politicians are, you know, just actively hate television, hate being on television, where some love it. Now, you know, when Ken Clark, for instance, who I made a film about, was Chancellor, he would go on all the time as Chancellor, whereas his successor, Norman Lamont, he would go on once a year. And so sometimes it has to do with what they feel like in front of the cameras and so on, how they've grown up as far as television is concerned, and also their sense of going into a TV studio and they're the big cheese and they like it. And also those ones who are confident enough to make a joke and all that also has something to do with it. But the prime ministers particularly are always sort of concerned and are on guard in terms of what they say, because they know that any small slip could send the FTSE 100 crashing downwards. So you have to have a sense of sympathy with them, because they can't be as candid as they might perhaps want to be, and often do become that once they stop being Prime Minister.
Yes, especially, I can imagine people like Ed Balls, for instance, who I thought was the driest man alive when he was a politician, and now he's probably become a Strictly Come Dancing superstar and a baker.
Someone can go too far in terms of their embrace of the media.
Well, this is a half hour podcast, unfortunately, so as much as I'd love to interview you for another half hour, I feel we might be drawing to a close. So I have two more questions for you. And my first one is, what is your golden rule for making documentaries? Do you have one?
Golden rule. Well, I'll give you my golden rule in terms of who I choose when I've made political portraits, and political biographies, which are what I've done most, is they have to have been at or near the top in British politics. They have to have what Dennis Healy calls a hinterland. They're not just a politician, they have a life beyond that. Often, you know, say in his case, he was a painter and a musician and a photographer. And they have to know where the bodies are buried and be prepared to talk a little bit candidly about at least the environs of where the bodies are buried and what state the bodies were when they were put in their grave. And also, kind of crucially, they have to be that sort of person who can do an hour of television. People will be prepared to watch an hour of television and be interested in them. And even a lot of them, and this has often been the greatest praise I've ever had for things, is often people said, I didn't want to watch it, and I started watching it, and I realized she was not the ogre I thought she was. It was actually a much more interesting person than that. And that's great, because you have brought something up that people didn't know that well. That's the kind of criteria that I have for who I want to make a film about.
Yes, I can see how Dominic Cummings would be the perfect subject in that case. Certainly, he knows where the bodies are buried and in what state of decomposition they are in. To draw things to a close then, what's one thing you hope people will take away from reading your book?
From reading this book? Well, I hope they will enjoy it. I hope they will find some of the stories that I have found funny, amusing, difficult, dark. Over the years, there's so much ups and downs in both in the world of politics and in the world of working for the BBC and getting a thing on the air and all that. And I hope that something like the kind of almost complete cynicism about politics that there is among so many people, that what Peter Mallison said, making them appear human, will actually make people understand that politics is much more complicated and difficult, but sometimes really rewarding than the kind of caricature that there is of it often in the media.
Yes, absolutely. Michael Cockerell, thank you very much.
Thank you, enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If hearing Michael's insights has piqued your interest, then why not check out his book, Unmasking Our Leaders? It's out now and available from all good bookshops. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.